The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. What a busy day. Wow. All right, we're rolling in toward the end of the week. Glad you're along. We have a very interesting program for you tonight, a very controversial program in some ways. I think that all of you would agree, who have been listening to this program for any length of time at all, that World War II remains almost as much mystery as it is fact. There is so much twisted and rewritten by the people who won, as opposed to the people who were vanquished and paid a terrible price for that. It was a terrible epoch in history. World War II really just part two of World War I. But without question, one of the most provocative subjects of World War II is now and will always likely be Auschwitz and what really happened at Auschwitz. Controversy. That didn't come close. The director of Auschwitz, the Auschwitz State Museum in Poland, Dr. Franciszek Piper, said on video to David Cole years ago that the primary attraction, if you can call it that, in Auschwitz, the gas chamber, was actually modified and constructed to appear to be a gas chamber after the war ended by the Soviets under orders of Joseph Stalin to keep people hating Germany. This is widely talked about in revisionist history and is even beginning to make some news in other areas of history that are more mainstream. Dr. Piper, was he crazy? 17 years on the job as director of the world's most infamous museum, one would not think so. That's just the tip of the iceberg, though. There are so many contradicting and conflicting aspects of Auschwitz and what happened there that I thought, I know this is going to sound funny, but I thought over 20 years ago that there was one man I had to have on this program. And I finally have succeeded in presenting him to all of us tonight. And I'm looking forward to hearing what Dr. Are you a doctor, Fred?
No, I'm not.
All right. We'll hold off the honorary degrees then. This is Fred Leuchter. Now, that's L-E-U-C-H-T-E-R. And you can pronounce... How do you pronounce it, Fred?
Leuchter.
Leuchter. Okay. Now, see, you've solved a 20-plus-year-old riddle for me. So in German, it would be Leuchter, I guess.
Leuchter, yes.
Yeah. Okay, but you pronounce it Leuchter.
Yes.
Very good. But we can all say Fred.
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you for being on here, Fred. I really appreciate it, and this is going to be very, very intriguing for me, and I hope all of you out there. Fred's background is fascinating. Some of you will know his name from the Fred Luster Report that is probably available online. I used to have a hard copy of it because I was curious about World War II from a very young age. I wanted to know as much as I could know about it. And the more I looked into it, the more contradictions I found. Is that a fair statement in your world, Fred?
I think that's true, yes.
Now, you have a background that is unusual. You had a specialty that not many people can lay claim to. Tell us what you were doing before you got involved in this whole controversy.
Well, initially, I was an engineer that worked on navigational systems. I have several patents in the area of metrology. I'm sure all of your listeners have seen these surveyors on the road with these so-called total stations they have. And I designed the device that encodes the actual motion of the telescope.
Oh, how interesting.
It's digital information, so it can be utilized by a computer. Then beyond that, I also have a background of having worked on execution equipment. I became involved a number of years ago when I was asked privately to look at an electric chair in Massachusetts when the legislature had reinstated the death penalty. In the final analysis, the legislature then, in its infinite wisdom, decided to unreinstate it a couple of years later. Uh-huh. So the state never did anything, but my name was given to the other states that did have capital punishment, and I was contacted, and I was asked for help by most of these states.
You actually became known in that portion of our society as the expert in capital punishment in some ways. You were all over the place.
Yes, I worked with most of the states that had capital punishment in one way or another. I'm also a certified expert in the federal court system in the United States, having been qualified and having testified when there were failures of execution equipment.
Ah, I bet you have. That's a very unusual niche to occupy. You have spent how many years studying and being involved with execution equipment and the whole theory of capital punishment?
More than 30 years.
Okay. Now, we can move forward, I guess. Well, first, where did you go to school and what's your education like?
I went to Boston University. I graduated in 1964. My degree is in, it was a liberal arts school. My degree is in history. Mm-hmm. I did further study at the Harvard Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in terms of celestial mechanics that I utilized in the development and my work in navigational equipment.
Oh, fascinating. So, well, that's quite a start to a conversation we're going to move into now. The Luster Report, now it's Leuchter, I do believe is available online. It's not very long, but it is a blockbuster.
Yes.
Because it raises questions that have upset a lot of people. And let's just leave it at that for the moment. We'll get there as we get there. What's your personal life like, Fred? This is a... Working with capital punishment, any issues with that with you?
No, I became involved because I am opposed to capital torture. Most of the states, when capital punishment was reinstituted after the Furman decision, most of the states, quite frankly, didn't know what they were doing. They had protocols that were written some 30, 40, 50 years ago. Most of them were on brown, crumbling paper that they could hardly read. They had no idea of what they were doing. Their equipment was old and obsolete.
Wow.
And prone to failure.
Prone to making people go through agonizing deaths, obviously.
Yes, Yes, and I think everybody's familiar with that. They've seen what has happened, primarily in the state of Florida with Jesse Tafaro when they set his head on fire.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they blamed it on the sponge.
Yes.
So yeah, I had supplied the helmet to the state of South Carolina, and I use nothing but artificial sponge in my when I build a helmet or when I make a helmet because of the uniform thickness, and it guarantees that you get a uniform transmission of current without any voltage drop. Well, the state of Florida, in order to cover up their mistake, they mm-hmm. had a defective electrode that melted. They said that it was because they used artificial sponge, which was a mistake. And to prove this, they put a piece of dry sponge in a toaster and turned the toaster on, and they set the sponge on fire, and they said, oh, my God, look at what happens to artificial sponge. Well, I mean, you can set anything on fire if you put it in a toaster. It was ludicrous,
yeah.
And when I was testifying in Florida, they brought the chief engineer from South Carolina down, and he testified that they used nothing but natural sponge in the helmet that they purchased off Fred Lucha. And Fred Lucha uses nothing but natural sponge. At which point, Fred Lucha got on the stand 10 minutes later and explained how he only uses artificial sponge. So they were kind of silly.
Black humor,
yeah.
As they say. Wow, that's a story. Well, we go back, and maybe one of the most famous executions would be certainly Timothy McVeigh would be one of them. There's been too many mass murderers out there to count anymore. Most of them kill themselves now. Not sure if they're mind controlled and programmed to do that or not. There's a lot of debate about that as well. So hard to say. All right. Now, majoring in history at Boston University, World War II. What drew you to World War II, and tell us your story of your visit to Auschwitz?
Well, I hadn't given Auschwitz much thought up until the point that I was sent. I had assumed that there were gas chambers. I had assumed that they had executed thousands and thousands, 6 million perhaps, Jews. I wasn't aware of what happened. I was taught that in school, and I've heard it from the news media, so I believed it. And I was contacted by Dr. Robert Forreson, who was working
the French professor. Yes, I know him. Yeah,
he was working with the Zundel defense team, and he had indicated to Zundel and his people that what they needed was an expert on execution technology, specifically gas chambers, and the only place they were going to get it was the United States.
Hmm.
They came to the United States, they asked several wardens for help, and they were referred to me.
Hmm.
And I was briefed by Dr. Forreson. I went to Canada and met with Ernst Zundel and Doug Christie and his defense team. And I was told what I would be asked to do by the court. I believed that I was going to find gas chambers, and I told Ernst Zundel that no matter what happens when I get there, if I find there were gas chambers, I'm going to report to the court as such. And additionally, if I find that they could have been gas chambers, I'm going to report to the court as such.
Mm-hmm.
And Ernst Zundel was adamant. He said, I know what you're going to find. Go find it, which is what I did. I went to Auschwitz and Birkenau.
Mm-hmm.
I studied the facilities there, and I found that they couldn't have been gas chambers. The facilities didn't lend themselves to even being turned into them. I did Ernst Zundel a disservice because I tried to design the buildings and make them into gas chambers in my mind, and I found that it was impossible.
The buildings that are to this day represented as gas chambers. Now, we do know from German records that the camps were equipped with smaller rooms to de-louse and sanitize, if you can use that word, bedding, blankets, mattresses, yes, uniforms. These were gas chambers, but they're very small, about the size of a living room or something.
Yeah, they were the size of a closet, and they were designed the same way our disinfection chambers were that we put the astronauts through when they came back from the moon.
Ah.
They were put in one side. They did whatever they were supposed to do for their time period in the chamber, which was a gestation period for some unknown bug, I guess, and then they were let out the other side. Well, the Germans, all they had in these disinfection chambers was a clothes rod that went across the whole room from one door to the other. They put all these lice-infected clothes into the chamber. They closed the door on both sides. They utilized the Zyklon B. They threw it into the furnace. They heated it up, forced hot air through it, in through the clothes that were hanging in the delousing facility.
Mm-hmm.
When it was done, they exhausted and pumped fresh air through the facility, probably for 8 or 10 or 15 hours to make sure that there was no residual hydrogen cyanide gas. And that stuff is difficult because it hides in pockets and stuff and is very dangerous.
I see.
Then they'd open the door on the other side and they'd air it out, and then they'd take all the clothes out and the clothes were fit to wear.
Fred, what is Zyklon B? Is it a bug spray? What is it?
Hydrogen cyanide.
So it is hydrogen cyanide.
Yeah. Yes. We utilize hydrogen cyanide basically in this country for executing purposes, and we also used it for fumigating railroad cars, steamships, and such. And what happens is you take either sodium, you take sodium cyanide or potassium cyanide pellets, and you throw them into a dilute solution, about 7% solution of sulfuric acid.
Right.
A gas is given off, which is hydrogen cyanide gas, and after it's done, the remainder is a very poisonous residue called prussic acid, which it's blue.
And that's Russian blue.
And that's where they get the Prussian blue, yes. That's
Prussian
correct.
Blue. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
okay, I've heard of that, yeah.
Now,
I'm learning as you go along. This is fascinating.
Now, this is how traditionally fumigation was done. We did it in the United States. We used to fumigate factories and houses by putting a tent over them and by putting hydrogen cyanide pellets into acid and fumigating the entire house, but then they'd have to take the tent down and they'd have to air the house out for maybe 4 or 5 days or a week. They wore rubber suits and gas masks when they did it as well, and they didn't breathe it. But the Germans, they improve on most things, and they decided that the pesticide hydrogen cyanide, which is what we used it for, was too dangerous and volatile to be handled. So what they did is they generated the gas the same way we do, but they did it in the factory, and they dissolved the gas into, or I should say absorbed the gas into chalk pellets.
Huh.
Now these chalk pellets are what became called Zyklon B. And in order to get the gas out of it, you have to blow hot air through the chalk pellets. And the gas then goes from a liquid or a damp condition in the pellet into a gaseous state, and that's called sublimation. And so by pumping this hot air through, the hydrogen cyanide comes out. And the Germans used this in the delousing chambers because it was safer to handle than throwing pieces of hydrogen cyanide or potassium or sodium or potassium cyanide into acid and then having to dump the poison afterward.
So
as a result, that's what they did, but it doesn't lend itself to running a gas chamber with 100 or 1,000 people in it, because you don't get enough gas out of the Zyklon B. You don't get enough gas out of the furnace. You heat the furnace, you blow hot air, and all the Zyklon B pellets are in a basket that the hot air blows through. It's a metal basket. But you only get enough for a small area. You don't get enough to fill a room with a few hundred people in it. In order to get enough gas to do that, we have to generate the gas on site, which is what we basically do. We generate the gas under the chair in the gas chamber.
In the gas chamber in the prison. Okay.
Yes. And then we have a long stack that the gas is then blown out of, which is the stacks are normally 50 feet in the air to get the poison area. Yeah, otherwise, you'd kill half the prison.
Messy stuff. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why the Germans built their delousing facilities out in the middle of nowhere.
So these architectural drawings showing the delousing facilities showed them separated for that reason. They were not integrated into the main part of the prison.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. I mean the concentration camps were in. When we think of Birkenau, they had areas that were wide open and spaced out more than a camp. The term reservation in what we normally think of applies. In other words, it's a big area that's reserved for the camp itself. And it's out in these remote areas that they would handle the dangerous Zyklon B.
Understand. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Very good. So you're in Germany. You go to the camp. And you're taken on a tour, I guess, of the primary gas chamber, which was purportedly used to... Well, the original plaque at Auschwitz said, through these gates passed 6 million people that would never come out alive. No, it was 4 million at Auschwitz. 4 million people who would never emerge alive.
Right.
And then they had to reduce that to 3, and another plaque said 2... And today's plaque says approximately 1 million people passed through these gates and did not come out alive.
My question in that respect is there was a good deal less than 6 million Jews in Europe at the time. More than 6 million Jews emigrated to the United States after World War II. If they killed more than they had, how did anybody leave?
That's a very good question.
So, yes, it's an interesting question. But at any rate...
At Auschwitz, with the plaques alone, and these are historically photographed, you go from 4 down to approximately 1... what is that? That's 3. So 3 from 6 is 3. And the 6 million, as you said, didn't exist before the war.
Right.
After the war, the Red Cross reports that there were more Jews alive in occupied Europe than were there before the war.
Right.
This is Red Cross literature. They did a whole population census count. All right, when you went into the gas chamber itself, the alleged gas chamber, the killing machine, the bad one. Tell us what you saw.
I saw a big open room that was a brick building with stuccoed walls, a stuccoed ceiling. It was originally painted probably white or gray. It had a large arch open doorway into the crematory area, where obviously the hydrogen cyanide gas is extremely volatile and explosive. And that's why we strap people down when we execute them, so they don't cause a spark and blow the chamber apart. So as a result, you couldn't have a furnace in the same building that you had Zyklon B.
So the crematories that they show people today are much too close to that building, if that building were used as a Zyklon B gas chamber.
Yes, it's all they are is another room in the building.
That's
separated by a notch, not even by a door. None of the doors in the facilities were gas proof.
Oh, really? So they weren't sealable?
No, they're made out of wood.
All right. Well, how do you have a gas chamber with doors that aren't sealable?
You have a lot of dead people that operate the gas chamber, if that's the case. And the SS wasn't stupid. They didn't kill themselves. That's for sure.
The inside of the room allegedly has, I've read, drains in the floor.
Yes.
And those floor drains go where?
They go right out into the sewer system, the catch basin system of the camp.
The whole camp?
Yeah. So if you did, because I had my head down and I'm looking out with flashlights and we could hear the sound of people out in the street. We hollered through the drains. So effectively, what happens here? If you release cyanide gas into the room, it would go out through the drain and probably kill somebody in two or three buildings removed from where you were in the camp.
Oh my! All right.
Yeah.
This
oh,
is
my,
getting
my, right.
more unusual every moment.
Yes.
The supposed the fake shower heads, were they there?
No, the fake shower heads were at Dachau. And
I see.
The interesting thing about Dachau is after I reviewed the facilities in Birkenau and Auschwitz, and I testified in court, I subsequently was asked by Ernst Nolan to investigate several of the other facilities, and Dachau was one of them. Dachau has a really elaborate supposed gas chamber. It's got nozzles on the ceiling that supposedly gas came out of. And when I was there, I had my draftsman along with me, and I did the same thing there that I did at the other facilities. I measured everything. And Ernst Zundel had given me a copy of the congressional record, because right after Dachau was captured by the Allied forces, Eisenhower brought half of Congress over to view the alleged gas chamber at Dachau. Now, subsequently, the so-called experts who claim that the gas chamber was a real gas chamber, they said it was never used. Why it was never used, we don't know, because it had a room that would maybe have held 50 or 80 people. But they said they sent everybody to Mauthausen to be executed, and the alleged gas chamber at Mauthausen was a shower room that you could get about 4 people in. So why you'd send people from a larger facility to a smaller facility is beyond me. But at any rate, the facility at Dachau had high-pressure steam lines directly above it, which would have caused the gas to explode. None of the shower heads were ever connected. But I had the congressional record, and what I couldn't seem to understand was the fact that none of my measurements, and I was getting the actual measurements at the scene, matched those of Congress. And I told Ernst this, and Ernst Zundel said he had a newspaper clipping that went back to 45, and he dug out the clipping, and it seems that there were 2 U.S. soldiers who were carpenters, and they claimed to have built the gas chamber before the senators came. And apparently the scenario was this. Eisenhower had these people build a phony gas chamber out of wood and paper. In other words, a regular building inside the brick building that the so-called browser bath or the shower rooms or the gas chambers were located. After the congressman left and they took all the measurements, they tore everything out and they built a permanent one. But the problem is they didn't maintain the same dimensions. And I get dimensions that don't match Congress. And you know Congress. If Congress does anything, they're meticulous in their documentation of records to the extent of being foolish.
Interesting.
But in this case, we have a situation where the measurements of the so-called gas chamber don't match the original measurements. So... And I only found that out by accident. But at any
rate, that's quite an interesting discovery.
Yes.
What else did you find out about the inside? You mentioned Prussian blue earlier.
All of the delousing facilities are coated with Prussian blue staining.
To this day.
Yes, to this day, the hydrogen cyanide permeates the brick and the mortar and goes right through from one side of the wall to the other.
Huh.
The term that they use to describe that is it migrates through the wall. Now it forms an inert, harmless substance that's Prussian blue after it's cured. But before that, what it actually is, hydrogen cyanide forms a very permanent and a very hard bond that will last for thousands of years with iron. And most of the water in the area of Poland where the facilities were loaded with iron. The water was used to make the mortar and the bricks, so therefore the bricks and the mortar were loaded with iron. That combined with the hydrogen cyanide to form a ferrocyanide compound, which we see today as Prussian blue. But we didn't find any Prussian blue in the so-called gas chambers. There was nothing at all. There was a very minimal trace chemically when we analyzed it, and all that is indicated was the fact that at one time or another, they fumigated the area, which uh-huh. they were supposed to do to all the barracks and everything all the time.
Huh.
It appears as though I don't think that that they had enough funds to fumigate the areas as much as they should have. Otherwise, we would have had higher concentrations in the so-called
gas
chamber,
yes.
which actually all it was a morgue. It was a morgue where they kept it was partially underground. It was two-thirds underground, mm-hmm. and they built their morgues underground. What they called the Leichenkeller, which actually means a body cellar.
Hmm.
They built them underground because they kept the bodies cool, and that was adjacent to the crematory, so they could take them in and cremate them.
So we cremate people today all the time.
Yes.
To bury people during the war would be inefficient, and I assume that that's one of the reasons that they were using crematories. I did read someone who had extrapolated if 6 million people had perished, God forbid, what a horror that would have been, it would have taken 75 years to cremate them, given the cremation facilities that were existing in the camp.
Yes.
Have you heard that?
Yes, yep. I testified to that in court.
They would have been cremating bodies just slightly longer than World War II lasted. Well,
they probably would have been cremating them up until the mid-90s.
Right. So people died in those work camps, labor camps, concentration camps. They died of typhus. They died of certainly malnutrition. All of Germany was starving by 43, 44 because of the bombing around the clock from the Americans and the British. How did you find the camp itself when you were there? Did it appear to be a nightmare, or did it appear to be a labor, like a little village sort of labor facility for manufacturing?
It appeared to be a facility. It looked like a state hospital. In the United States around the 1880s or the 1890s. I mean, that's the type of building. They were brick buildings, and if I took you to Auschwitz and put you in one of the buildings and didn't tell you where you were, you'd assume you're in some kind of a hospital. Because that's what it was like.
They had
barracks, and they weren't about to abuse their workers. They weren't about to torture them or kill them. They kept them as healthy as they could because they needed them. Auschwitz and Birkenau we're supplying the labor for the IG Farben and Buna rubber facility, where they made all the artificial rubber that kept the Luftwaffe flying, that kept the Panzer divisions rolling. Without the, the Germans had no access to the rubber in the Far East.
Right. It was the world's largest artificial synthetic rubber production facility, among other things.
Yes.
And you certainly
weren't going to kill your workers.
No. So, now, the horrible pictures of the bodies, we've all seen them at the end of the war. If one looks at them and can tolerate the horror of it, one would notice that they are basically skin and bones. They were starving. The whole country was starving. I talked to one German man from a large family, and he said, we would have one potato and boil it in a big pot to make our family's dinner. That was it in 44. They just didn't have any food because the Americans were shooting and bombing everything that moved. So were the British. That's all trains, transit, trucks, you name it. Doesn't matter.
The interesting thing about that is that that all of these photos that we see of these dead bodies heaped on top of each other, they all came, and these photos were taken at one camp. It was the Belsen concentration camp where all these people starved to death. And as you said, Germany had no food. The first thing, if you're running a country and you're in a war and you got no food, you have to feed your army first. Then you got to feed your people first, second, and then you're going to feed your prisoners last. And all these people at Belsen starved to death. There were thousands of them. And what they do is they took a lot of photographs of them. And if you look at the photographs, you'll see that they've cropped the photographs. They flipped the negatives so they look the opposite, so you can't quite tell the same thing. They all came from that one camp, not from all these other camps.
I see. I remember Elie Wiesel in his book complaining bitterly about having to take three showers a day. I could never figure that out. And I finally realized that that was an effort to keep these people in working condition.
Yes. Oh, yes. They took reasonably good care of them there. They had a symphony orchestra. They had their own brothel.
I've seen pictures of dental work done there. So it's a swimming pool. Yep. Look, it's not morally correct to take anyone and put them in a concentration or work camp. That's not what this is about. What I'm hearing is a remarkable view of this situation by someone who was professionally qualified to evaluate it and who actually went there and didn't look at a television docudrama or a motion picture about it.
Yes. I saw them before I went.
You must have been quite surprised by what you actually encountered there then, if what we're hearing is...
I was very surprised. I was flabbergasted. Because everything that I had been told up to that point was not true. It was a lie.
Well, as I mentioned, Dr. Piper, the director of the entire museum for they call it a museum, Memorial Museum, for 17 years said that the gas chamber facility that is shown to everyone was, in fact, at one point, something entirely different. It was made into a, quote, gas chamber after the war ended under orders of Joseph Stalin.
Yeah.
So you say it was a morgue, it might have been a bomb shelter, but that doesn't work either because none of these camps were bombed during the war for fairly obvious reasons, but not even the rail lines to them were interrupted, which is very interesting.
No, and we've been criticized for that. But the thing is that we didn't bomb them because there was no need to bomb. You don't bomb prisons.
No.
Yeah.
No.
And you know it's the same thing. The supporters of the Holocaust have been very critical of the wartime Pope and the Catholic Church. Now, the Catholic Church is the biggest intelligence organization that ever existed on this planet. You had thousands of parishioners. Mm-hmm. You had thousands of priests and clergy, nuns, and all of these religious personnel all over the place. They heard things, and you can be sure that all this information was fed to the Vatican.
Yeah, let's not forget pedophiles either. They had a lot of that, and still do. Well, unfortunately,
that may be. But the only point that I'm making is that none of this information about the gas chambers was mm-hmm. ever passed because mm-hmm. it wasn't going on.
So I understand there was no intelligence reporting mass executions of millions of people in these
right.
labor camps.
Right. Right. And you can be sure they would have reported it.
Yeah, well, the Red Cross had facilities in Auschwitz during the war, did it not?
Yes, it did. Yep. Yes.
So how are you going to fool the Red Cross? People would point to the chimneys of the crematories and say, they're burning, but, well, they were cremating the dead. Any idea, Fred, in your view of how many people actually perished during the war at Auschwitz or in the camps in collective? Have you got a number?
Well,
the Red Cross has one after the war, but I want to see what you have to say.
I believe that the death books that came from Auschwitz that were released by the Russians and given to Yad Vashem in Jerusalem.
Now, these are books with every name of every person who passed away. Remember, the Germans were meticulous record keepers.
Yeah. I believe there was less than 300,000 people that died, and most of them weren't Jewish.
Most of them were or weren't?
Were not.
I mean, okay, now this is another issue. Everyone thinks of the concentration camps as being populated solely by Jews, only Jews. Nothing could be further from the truth. There were gypsies, political prisoners, military prisoners who had run afoul, all kinds of people from society that were discriminated against to the extent that they were sentenced to these camps. So that's interesting. I was going to say the Red Cross figures around 280,000 to 290,000 died during the war. And again, the polls after the war, the census and statistics, all show people reporting or the head count that there were more Jews in Europe after the war than existed there before the war. So these are very, very provocative issues. When you went back to the Zundel trial and testified, were you able to present much of this evidence?
Well, it's interesting because the judge was biased, and although he was stuck with me as an expert witness because I was I'm a certified expert witness in federal court in the United States, he accepted me as a witness, but he wouldn't accept the report. So Doug Christie had to get everything that was in the report testified into the record. So I essentially had to sit there
and read
parts of the report.
I'll be darned.
But the judge pulled a funny. He refused to allow me to testify on the crematory information because I wasn't a qualified crematory expert. Now, as any engineer I studied it. I spent 3 weeks at a crematory here in Massachusetts watching bodies being cremated and talking with the people that were doing it to find out how it was done today, how it was done in the past. And, you know, you have to research something before you can write about it and examine something that already was in place. Which is what I did.
Yeah.
But he refused to allow me to testify that, and that's when he brought Ivan Legace in, who was the top crematory expert in Canada. And much to the judge's chagrin, Ivan read the half of my report that dealt with the crematories into the record and certified for the court that it was all correct.
Oh, what a scene that must have been.
So it turned out better because they had a crematory expert saying the same thing. So, you know.
Does it not take some kind of fuel to cremate people? I mean, you need gas. Natural gas, something to get the temperature up high enough to do the cremating, correct?
Yes, well, the facilities that that they had in Europe were fired by coal and coke.
Okay.
Mostly coal,
mm-hmm.
And you could get a you couldn't get a super hot fire, but you could get a fire that was certainly warm enough. But instead of cremating in over a period of 10 to 12 hours, it took 18 hours. You know,
18 hours to do one body or one load of bodies.
Yeah. They have to be done one at a time.
Hold on. One at a time.
Yeah.
How many ovens are there or were there at Auschwitz?
There was only four.
That's my understanding. Yeah. I've seen pictures of four.
Yeah.
So four ovens, four bodies, 18 hours each on average to dispose of one body.
Right.
Now, if there were millions of dead bodies, that's going to run the picture of 75 years up even higher, I would think.
Yeah, I told you they would have been cremating people into the 90s.
Yeah.
You know,
wow.
But remember, you still have to deal with the crematories at Birkenau.
Mhm.
I mean, there's Crema 2, Crema 3, and you know, the two of them may not even have been crematories. They were. They may not have even have been. Even though they say they were gas chambers, they were one-story buildings made out of brick on a concrete slab. The two, Crema 2 and Crema 3, they were a little bit different because they had underground morgues. They had conveyor belts for moving bodies up and down from the morgue into the crematories.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, they were more sophisticated. They certainly were not capable of supporting gas executions. But they were capable of cremating the people that died at the camps.
Mm-hmm,
yes.
Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to bring out, and we have about 3 minutes left, Fred, is at the end it is said, and again I'm just repeating what I've read and heard, that when the Russians were approaching Auschwitz, the inmates were given a choice: stay or go west with the guards as they were evacuating. True or not true?
I don't really know. I wasn't there.
I do know
that the facilities had been destroyed by the time the Russians arrived, and as well they should have been. You know, the argument has been made they were destroyed because they were trying to cover up what they were doing. That wasn't the issue at all. The issue is you just don't let anything good fall into the enemy hands. Particularly, the Germans weren't going to let anything fall into the Russian hands.
So all those barracks and so forth could have been turned into a camp of sorts, a military staging area. That's what you're saying. I see.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What have not we touched upon that you'd like to mention in our last couple of minutes here? That's an extraordinary firsthand account. You did sample scrapings in the so-called.
Yes, I removed samples.
Uh-huh.
They were removed in accordance with the with proper forensic techniques.
Mm-hmm.
The materials were brought. They were given to a lab here in Massachusetts that was fully qualified to test these samples.
Mm-hmm.
The lab tested them, not knowing what they were. They were told it was for an industrial accident case. And because I didn't want to put anybody into the same position that I was in,
mm-hmm.
I had to deal with whether or not these things were gas chambers, and I didn't believe they were. I didn't want these chemists under the same burden.
Mm-hmm.
So they weren't told what they did. They were only asked to produce results, and they did produce results, and they showed that there was absolutely no hydrogen cyanide used in the alleged gas chambers.
At Auschwitz.
Yes.
This is just amazing. And I would again mention that the Lustre report is online. I think you can read it online. Can't you, Fred?
Yeah, I believe so. Yes.
Yeah. And it's done by a man, and I think you can tell is very serious about his knowledge, about his contribution and his work and looking into this. How would you term the whole Auschwitz story then?
Well, Well, it's nothing more than a big lie. I mean, I believe from what I've read that it was propaganda started by the British Secret Service during the war. The same thing they did during World War One when they called the Germans the Huns. Of course, the Huns were Asiatics; they weren't Germans. They did that. It's just black information that they and misinformation,
yeah.
And that's all they did. So, that's where the story started, and I think it's turned out to be a very great moneymaker for Israel.
Oh, a huge cash cow. Huge.
Yes.
Huge. Fred Luscher, thank you very much. I've waited over 20 years for this, and it's been well worth the wait. I salute you, and thank you for your honor and integrity.
Thank you.
For sharing.
Maybe we can talk again sometime.
Well, I'd like to. We have, I'm sure, much more to put on the table. Thank you, Fred.
Thank you, Jeff. You have a nice evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Good night. Fred Luscher. And every coin has two sides, so there's the other side of the Holocaust story as it pertains to the camps in and around Auschwitz. All right. We'll be right back.